that's UHF antenna. So, you know, they're making it known that way that it's required. But, you know, let's talk about the Midwest where people need to have reception to know when tornadoes are coming, which brings us to the problem of centralization of radio stations, whereas that nowadays you can call up your local radio station and there's nobody there, and it's coming from Chicago or some other place that's out of the world. So that whole sense of localism, this is a whole nother discussion, a whole nother awful thing. And considering that digital television kind of sort of works, but not really well, this world, or at least this country, is in for a rude awakening sometime soon. K2RW, KE2J.
Okay, I heard QIQ, I think I heard Alex, but we've got Paul who signed in earlier. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead.
2EO, JK. What's the possibility of, I have an antenna here. It's like a 13-element beam that was originally made for Channel 68 years ago. If I put that on top of, let's say on top of my rotator that I use for, I've got a 10-element Cushcraft beam facing toward the repeater now. If I put this thing above that, or below it, whatever, say at the 25-foot level, and QTH is in Monocacoma, and I pointed it to the city. When if I, you know, you're talking about Channel 13 being on 61, and this was designed for Channel 68. I wonder if I'd have a shot at picking up Channel 13. It sounds like fun. I'll probably do this anyway. I could always swing it around and see what I get in Connecticut and whatever, but I wonder what the odds are. 50-50? What do you think, Dick? Back to you, WS2N.
And 2EO. Okay, we got a whole bunch of people signing in. N2EO has been added to the list. Between channel 61 and 68, you've got 7 channels, 6 times 7 is 42, 42 megacycles lower. The good news is Yagi antennas fall off more slowly on the low side than the high side. In other words, take a Yagi designed for frequency X, and you go lower in frequency, it slowly falls off in gain. Go higher in frequency, and you get a cliff effect. So I give you better than a 50-50 chance. But Paul, you live out in Ronkonkoma, which I'm pretty sure is considered a Baker fringe area. When we finally get back to Eric, he'll correct me on that. So you're going to have to put up a reasonably enthusiastic antenna on the outside of your house, hopefully a reasonably high gain antenna, hopefully with a rotator. And there's at least two reasons why you want the rotator. One, you want to find that magic direction of aiming the antenna where the magnitude of the multi-path signals is within the range that your particular converter is happy with. Second of all, with that rotator, because you're as far out on Long Island as you are, an awful lot of your reception is going to come from Connecticut. With a rotator, you can pick up Connecticut and Rhode Island, as well as doing some television DXing. So give that antenna a try, but start your backup plan now for the high-gain antenna with rotator that I think you're going to want if you're an over-the-air television-watching person. If you're a person that's happy with cable TV or satellite TV, then maybe this is just a minor experiment, and your television watching is no problem. Now, of the long list of people, we've got Glenn, Alex, and Rich in that order, I think. Glenn first, KC2QIQ. Wait for some delay, Glenn. K2LIW in the tech net.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Just two quick comments. The antenna that Paul was talking about, the Channel 56 antenna, I started with that antenna to start DXing with the HDTV. And what I found out was that the tuning network, that where you connect, where you screw the coax in on the back half of the Yagi, is very, very narrow band. And you were lucky if you got two channels and they were really cruddy. And that was from here in Massapequa, where he's located. It'll even be worse. What I wound up doing was pulling off that part of the antenna that was the tuning part where you plug in the coax right at that one spot, pull that one element off, and then put on basically one of the bow tie style mounts for tuning for your standard UHF coupling. Put that in and then added reflectors off the back, and then it would tune most of the UHF band. That's actually my modified antenna. As far as Radio Shack is concerned, they're going to continue to carry that Turkey antenna. It's like about $180, I think, and they're going to continue to carry that. Back over to you, Dick. KC2, QIQ.
But Dick, they've got stuff on the web.
Yeah, give me a couple of words on the Turk antenna. I've done some work with Turk, and I know about some of their antennas. What does this $180 Turk antenna look like, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, the Turk, the TV38, I think, is the one. It's a VHF, UHF, FM antenna. It has the wad periodic section on the antenna with the UHF section towards the front with the collector. So it kind of looks a little bit like the antenna that Paul's talking about, sticking off the end of it, and then basically has the wad periodic, moving towards the back to carry all the way down to channel 2. So right now that's Turk model 38, TV-38, and Radio Shack is going to continue to carry that for quite some time, Dick. KC2, QIQ.
Okay, that's pretty good to know. I think I heard Alex in the N2AAU. I may have misunderstood the voice. Was that your voice in there, Alex? If so, go right ahead with some delay.
I think that was me, Dick, N2EO. I just went on RadioShack.com. They've got about 7 or 8 antennas. Some are available in the store. Others say web only. In other words, RadioShack.com.
Okay. When it comes to fringe area, great big aerials for the guys that are pretty serious. They're out in the fringe area, and maybe they want to do some television DXing. And I guess they would be listed as an antenna that's intended for, let's say, 75-mile reception in the old days. Is that what's in the catalog? Give us some words as to how big, how many dollars, and whatever is in the catalog, Rich. N2EO, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. I saw the Turk. They got 2 WineGuard. They say high-band VHF and UHF. They explicitly say for HDTV. Those are web-only. I don't know what the difference are. There's 2 WineGuards. They're $149.95. They still sell, I believe the one you have was, it's a long boom 57-element antenna. That says web-only, I believe. I got to take another look. They got some other ones that you can pick up in the store. I guess there's maybe about 6 or 8 of them there. Some of them you can get in the store. Some say web-only. And I've done a lot of shopping with RadioShack.com, and they're pretty good. You get stuff in about from the time you order on a card, you'll get it about 6 or 7 days later, maybe sooner.
Now, web-only implies that it's not in the local store, it's in a warehouse somewhere, and maybe they ship it to the local store. In the case of the aerial that I bought that's in a box that's about 10 feet long, I don't think that can easily be shipped. So how do you buy a long boom antenna that's web-only? Does it have to be delivered to the store, or can it be delivered to my house? Over to you, Rich.
Hey, Dick.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, on that site, the install only is 160-inch long boom, 57-element antenna. It's the catalog number, blah, blah, blah. It's $100, $99.95. And then, of course, they have the Turk, which comes out of Fort Worth.
So, once again now, I pick it up from the local store, or do they try to deliver that great big thing to my house?
Dick, either way, I've had stuff shipped to me. They will ship, they generally ship FedEx Radio Shack to your door.
KC2 QIQ?
Yep. Also, the in-store antennas, like the 160-inch long, if they don't have it in stock, you can have the store order it.
I'm curious as to whether or not any of these shipping services will ship something that's 10 feet long to my house or 12 feet long. Let's see what Glenn's got to say. KC2 QIQ, little delay, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick. I've had a lot of antennas here now shipped through the mail. I've actually had them dropped off UPS, FedEx, among all the other carriers. And those are including the large Cushcraft beams I've had, the VHF beams, the UHF beams, HF beams, and my MA5B came that way. There should be absolutely no problem at all with one of those little 10-foot boxes, that's going to carry you like a Turk 38, type of antenna to the house. So I wouldn't expect that as being much of a problem. And the other advantage to the TV antenna over, say, like the Cushcraft beams that I've ordered recently is they're even lighter. So there really shouldn't be a problem at all. KC2 QIQ.
Okay. We're slowly learning. Anyone with any further questions or comments on the subject of digital television reception? That's the main subject on the floor for the last 3 weeks, and it's still on the floor. Anyone with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters and name right now. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Whiskey.
Go ahead, Joe.
Papa.
I did hear Papa Whiskey again. Go right ahead, Papa Whiskey. That's Brett. Go ahead, Brett.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Comment on the boom and the antenna length. 8 foot is the UPS threshold of expensive versus not, but most of those TV antennas do come busted down into two sections, and you sleeve them and you put them together. So the station Massapequa was right there. Awful light also. My question is for Eric, of course. Analog VHF, UHF television reception in a mobile environment has always been difficult. The flutter results in rapid, bright-dark analog changes. There's a staticky sound to the sound. And, of course, multipath causes terrific ghosting. If you're not in a very, very, very prime signal area, analog is terrible. One of the solutions was diversity antennas, where the tuner will have two or four antennas. It'll rapidly switch back and forth and pick the best signal from from millisecond to millisecond. But my question is, how does digital fare in the mobile environment? Over.
Yeah, that's going to be a beauty. Eric, do you think that even with diversity reception from a great big limousine with a whole bunch of antennas on it, I can see the possibility of a very special installation that would try to emphasize this, but I think in general, the equalizer is going to have a bit of a difficulty keeping up with a mobile environment if I'm moving that vehicle more than, let's say, 5 or 10 miles an hour. That's a guess on my part. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
K2RW, K2J. Well, there is a new standard. It's called EVSB M/8, meaning mobile and handheld. It is really a 2 and 4 VSB signal that is compatible with the 8 VSB signal. And it is, you'll probably see it sometime next year or the year after. I've actually seen a couple of different demonstrations in Las Vegas of mobile reception. We're not talking high def because we don't have the bandwidth for it. The bit rates are much lower for that to work. As far as there's many people that have tried diversity reception for mobile and have kind of come close, but forget it. It ain't happening. It's like the guy out in Riverhead trying to pick up Channel 61. That all happens when it snows on the equator.
Now, the 2 and 4 VSB mode of transmission can tolerate a lot more multipath, a lot more motion, and still give an acceptable picture. However, that is a different kind of transmission. Am I correct to assume that if the signal is originally transmitted in 8 VSB, I don't have the ability to suddenly decide to listen to that exact same signal in 2 or 4 VSB in order to get better thresholding? That if I'm now restricted to only the 2 and 4 VSB signal, therefore, from my mobile environment, in general, there's going to be a very small number of channels that I can watch, is my guess. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Well, that's the beauty of the VSB system. The way we actually generate the vectors, and the way there's actually, when you look at the signal on a spectrum analyzer, there's actually very small points of that signal that contain the information. There's a lot of dead space, if you want to call it that. But that's the beauty of enhanced VSB, is that you can be simultaneously transmitting a 2 VSB, a
along with the 8 BSD on the same frequency at the same time. I mean, it's a long discussion in terms of how it actually works. The training signal and the timing is a little bit different, but the concept is, in the end, that the mobile receiver is in a position to receive 8 BSD, the receiver will receive the 8 symbol. When it knows that it's in motion and it can't be receiving the 8 symbols, it'll cut back. It'll cut back to 4 and try that, and cut back to 2, and it will walk up to it and pick it up. Of course, the image quality will be lower because the station that is transmitting the enhanced VSD signal, even though they may be transmitting the same channel information, will be transmitting a reduced bit stream on those particular modes of operation, but they operate concurrently, simultaneously, on the same frequency. It's really misty the way it works, but that's a whole other discussion for another day.
Wow, I'm impressed. What is the disadvantage here, Eric? In other words, if my television transmitting station desires to transmit 8 VSB, as well as, let's say that was 4.0, what's going to become 4.0, as well as 4.1 and 4.2 and 4.4, if they then decide to transmit not only the 8 VSB, but the 2 and the 4 VSB simultaneously, is that using up a little bit of the available bandwidth, and therefore there's a slight sacrifice in the update rate I get for 4-2 to 4-4, so to speak? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, the beauty of the system is one doesn't affect the other. You got a 6 megahertz chunk of step stuff. But each set group of symbols transmit, we really have to get into the discussion of how this works. And then you have to get into the discussion of how the 8 BSD works. And because it's the form of vector modulation between where, if you look at the constellation, okay, if you think about a constellation, there's spaces between the constellation, right? Even though you're using all that space, you still got space in between the space. I don't want to start that now. Another day.
Okay. So, in the case of the 2 and the 4, I don't have to wait as long for it to settle. Or either I that or I do wait longer for it to settle. I'm getting a better integration time. And the answer itself, because my boxes of my constellation are larger for the 2 and the 4, I can tolerate a hell of a lot more, let's say, noise, and still fall close enough to the center of the box to not get an error in the demodulation process. That's what I think I'm beginning to see. But we'll get into that later. Obviously, there's a lot more to follow. There was another person who tried to sign in, and I didn't get his call letters. Why don't you give it another try right now? K2RIW in the TechNet.
You're basically right, Dick.
Okay. I'm not hearing another person in there. Let's give one more chance for our out-of-town person, Kent Britton, WA5BJB. If you want to add or subtract anything from what you heard, now's your opportunity. WA5BJB in the group, for the group, K2RIW listening.
W2 Papa Whiskey, thank you for the airtime and thank you for the questions, Eric and Dick. W2PWB on the side.
Very fine, Chris. Sounds like Kent got called away, or doesn't have anything to add, or at least didn't come through at this time. Mel, wonder if you got any further questions, and did we get any digital television questions on the website this week, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. That's about all I got. All kinds of comments and everything like that. A lot of people, I hope this cleared up some of the confusion. Like I say, the confusion is, you know, that they can't get it to work the way they think it should work right now, And is it the antenna? Is it the box? Should I change the box? Get a different box? What should I do? Should I take down? Now you know, just mentioned that do not pull down your conventional antenna that you have up there. Now, it will still be usable. See, there's one of the misconceptions, Dick, over.
Yep, got the wrong receiver turned on here. A lot of people, I'm getting the impression, misinterpreted the data that was on the websites on the subject. And since in the metro areas, 99% of all of the digital transmissions now are strictly UHF, people made a leap of faith and assumed that all digital transmissions in the future will only be UHF, and a significant number of people have begun removing their VHF antenna, and they've now got a backpedal, because channels 7 through 13, as I see it, will be significant channels. You're going to want to watch the frequencies of 7 through 13. You're going to want to watch beyond February 17th of 2009. So I hope some of these people didn't completely grind up the antenna like my buddy in Melville did today. He ground it up, threw it away, and now he says, oops, blank, blank. You can fill in the word. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Somebody was in there very weak. Did you catch him?
That's a super weak signal. I think he's on the other input. I'm going to go there right now. Let's see. Make another transmission and see if I can find out who it is.
KC2-OOA.
Okay, got you that time. KC2-OOA. Thank goodness you came through a lot better, Paul. Go right ahead. Nicely on the input. And Paul is not getting channel 61, which is really channel 13, I think it is. And he's made quite a few antenna changes in attempting to do that. Let's see now, what did I want to say about that? The channel 61, channel 13, 61, I think Eric has told us is only running 1,000 watts. He's in plain view, which is fairly close, and he's made quite a few changes and not been able to receive it. I wonder if you've got any possible suggestions for him, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
No, I couldn't hear through what was going on. What exactly did he say?
He's got the ability to mount the antenna either at 12 feet or 50 feet. He's made a number of changes to the antenna he's using. He's made multiple attempts to get channel 13 digital, which I think is channel 61, and in plain view he's not getting it. As I said, he's made multiple changes. He mentioned the Archer radio antenna that he's using, a Radio Shack product. I guess my real question to you, Eric, is with people with rooftop antennas with reasonably good quality, roughly how far out are they getting channel 61? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Well, here's the story. They start off with 1,000 watts. After they get up to the 86 floor and go through the combiner, and they get out of that, there's about maybe 700 watts at that point. When they finally make it up to the antenna, which is now split in two, so there's just 3 dB down at that point, actually through the loss through the pipe, they wind up with about 600 watts, lose 3 dB, in each antenna, one antenna is pointed to Brooklyn, the other antenna is pointing the other way, east. You figure it's around 300 and something watts. Forget it. It ain't happening. I can't even pick it up. But wait until the 17th. When they go back to 13, you'll probably be able to pick them up in the riverhead.
Hold on now. Run that by again. From your broadcast tower in plain view, where the antenna is mounted at a nice altitude with line of sight to New York City, to the Empire State Building, I think I heard you saying that the 300 watts of radiated power, with all of that splitting and line loss and whatever, you are not getting reception at 61 in Plainview? Did I hear you say that, Eric? Go ahead.
Let me say it correctly. I can't decode it. And I think that's because of the inter-symbol distortion that's going on. Because they have an antenna that's pointed, the main antenna is pointed east, and then they have another antenna that's pointed sort of southeast, and it's split in two, and I can guarantee you they don't have the same length of pipe from the split to the main antenna that's on the tower, the backscatter antenna. If you actually take a look at the Empire State Building these days, you'll see from the 81st floor going up on the setback there, it looks like there's two L's on it that are attached to the building. One is the backscatter antenna. The other is the standby antenna, and the main antenna is on the mooring mast. So I can't possibly imagine that those two signals aren't overlapping and mixing. So, I'm in the middle of constructing a nice long email to the guy who's in charge of it all, but I have to get all my facts perfect before I send it and get my assumptions exactly correct. So, you know, he doesn't think that this is just a raving lunatic writing him an email. But I have my theory about it. So I think if it was 6 months ago when we were on the original antenna, I'd say no problem. I used to get a booming signal from them. The signal's there, but the multipath is so bad that it just won't lock up.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized, but I've got a question here first, and that is, if you're transmitting from two or three separate antennas, some of them are aimed in the right direction, some of them are aimed in the wrong direction, from your point of view out in plain view, that's the equivalent to the multipath. What I'm getting is a light because of the different ranges, or if I'm getting multipath because I'm getting reflection of something in the terrain, I don't think the receiver can tell the difference. The fact that your receiver cannot separate those particular multipaths is leading to me to some kind of a continuous nature as opposed to a point source nature. In other words, if one of my antennas, from my particular point of view, is scattering a signal along the side of the building, and now I'm getting a continuous distribution of time delay, I think no equalizer can take that back out. Is there a slim possibility something along these lines is taking place temporarily, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. I wouldn't say temporarily. I mean, this is just my theory, okay? How much pipe does it take to delay a nanosecond? Or how much pipe does it take to delay a microsecond? Okay? If one symbol time is 92 nanoseconds, right? And you're going through, say, 300 feet of pipe to one antenna that's at one height, and you're going through 150 feet or 100 feet of pipe to the other antenna, then symbols ain't going to line up with each other. Now, that begs to bring us to another thought, because the FCC just recently accepted and is now permitting licensing of distributed transmission. And what that means is that you can put up a bunch of small transmitters to cover a large area rather than one big transmitter. But here you have two signals emanating from one point source that there's a time delay between them. I don't know what the facts are. Here's my problem. I mean, it was designed by Dielectric, and in theory it's supposed to work. In analog, I'd have no problem thinking about it because, you know, a little bit of an edge of a goat that you can barely see is nothing. But now we're talking about symbol time. So essentially,
my theory is that the two antennas, and they have not yet to operate just on a single antenna to find out if that's the case. It's what I'd really like them to do. And so we can find out, because I've taken my receiver that actually shows me what the equalizer is doing and brought it to various different places. And the first two taps, a full tilt, which says to me that there is a continuous problem in time delay between two symbols. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. But I'd sure like to find out. And it isn't a temporary problem, that's permanent. But when channel 13 goes to 13, when they go to 215 megahertz, that problem is going to be gone. Besides, I think VHF is going to beat the pants off of UHF in terms of how it works.
Which is saying the message stronger and stronger. Make sure you got a VHF upper, at least, antenna on your roof if you're an over-the-air reception person. 7 through 13 is not going away on February 17th. It's going to become damn important. Glenn, KT2QIQ, you've got it.
Yeah, just some quick comments about, you know, some of this, you know, TBDXing and some of the performance I've had here in Massapequa. Before this past summer, I was having really no problems receiving most of the channels that were out there with my old Motorola HD100 converter box that had a high definition output with composite output into the TV. Somewhere towards the end of the summer, in early fall, they must have made some kind of a change. I think Eric has alluded that to a lot of it's been the antenna. And I lost, channel 2 has just completely disappeared. I couldn't even scan it anymore. And the HD box is almost completely unusable. Then I went out and purchased, Eric had mentioned that Zenith DTT901. I purchased one of those, and just about all the channels that I was missing finally came back. Oddly enough, the one channel that didn't return here in Massapequa was channel 13. There was something like I think Eric kind of explained that even here in Massapequa, I can't really receive channel 13. Even with the Zenith DTT901, it'll scan it, and I can see it captures the channel, but it just pops in and out, and it's really not very dependable. But those are just some of my observations I figured I'd share. Back over to you, Dick. KC2QIQ.
I rest my case, and I can get into why 61 is more of a problem.
It's 200A.
All recognized. When I looked at that beautiful receiver of yours that's got the display showing me what the tap points are in magnitude, and I think I saw, it looked like about 25 or 30 individual bars to that thing. Maybe there's more of them. I am guessing that horizontally is time domain and vertically is voltage domain, plus or minus voltage. Is a tap point capability at various amounts of plus or minus voltage, and horizontally each one represents a certain time delay. Roughly how much time delay was there between each one of those vertical bars? Was it something like 100 nanoseconds or was it 10 nanoseconds? Over to you, Eric.
Now, in theory, the correct formulation for that is one tick per symbol. Okay, but it's not. It's actually a little bit fatter than that. They're about 100 nanoseconds apart. It goes out to, that one goes out to 70 microseconds. The one you were looking at, it goes forward 30 microseconds. His receiver that no longer works, which we call the Magnavox, it was marketed under many different, trade names. That has a third generation equalizer, which is actually equivalent to the equalizer that you were looking at the taps on. The velocity at which the RF travels through a 6-inch pipe at channel 61 is different than the velocity at channel 28. You agree with that, Dick?
I sure do, and that's called dispersion, particularly if it's a waveguide. And even if it's a TEM structure, there's still going to be a little bit of dispersion. Something is still bothering me, though, Eric. If each individual bar represents close to 100 nanoseconds, and the display goes out to 70 microseconds, that would mean there are 700 bars. Maybe only 50 of them are being displayed at a time. Back to you, Eric.
Don't you remember the little sliders that we were moving that expanded and contracted the whole thing?
Yes, I do now. It's slowly coming back. And these guys over 60 forget things. Okay, so I think you're saying there is a significant amount of dispersion between low and high frequencies going down the pipe. And when you say pipe, are you talking about air, coax line, or are you talking about waveguide? Over to you, Eric.
Well, the combiner is waveguide, but it goes to a button. And from there, it's a 6-inch copper pipe.
Okay, 6-inch copper pipe would have to be coax. No choice. You'd be waveguide being cut off other than that. Yes. Got to have more than a half wave diameter in order to transmit a waveguide signal. Paul had a question. KC2-00A, go right ahead, Paul.
KC2-00A, this one's directed towards Eric real fast. There was some rumor that because WLIW-21 is broadcasting 21-2, 21-3, 21-4, that when they go back to being channel 21, they will be 21-2 WLIW and 21-1 will be WLIW, 21-2 will be channel 13 radiating from Long Island, so that if we can get 13-1 New York City, we can get 21-2 Long Island and still pick up the channel 13 signal. Does that make any sense? KC2-00A in the group.
Yeah, I hope that's able to hear you. Your audio is more than 10 decibels weaker than it should be, Paul. You've got a medium, okay carrier, but very, very weak audio. So, should I repeat the question, Eric? KD2EJ, KD2RIW? Yes, please. Okay. When he watches, he can't get channel 13. And when he watches channel 21, 21.1 is channel 21. 21.2 is channel 13. So what he's suggesting is that for the people who can't get channel 13 directly from New York City, they can really be getting the equivalent of it by way of channel 21 from Plainview, 21.2. Is that true? Over to you, Eric.
Do I have a quote? Negative. That's incorrect. I give you the channel lineup. 13.1 is what we call now 13 HD, which is also the same as what's on 13 analog. 13.2 is a channel that we call 13 kids, which is an SD channel. 13.3 is VME, which is Spanish language. Okay, on 21, 21.1 is the same as analog 21. By the way, at the moment, all three channel 21 channels are SD, but we're going to be moving 21.1 HD probably in April. But currently, 21.1 is the same as 21 analog. 21.2 is something that we call create, and 21.3 is something we call world. There is a certain amount of duplication in the programming, so I mean, you can watch a whole bunch of stuff that's on 21 of the three channels that's also on 13 at different times. But a lot of the local programming for 13, don't forget, 13 is licensed in Newark, not New York City. So there's a lot of, like, Sunday Arts 13 doesn't show up on 21. There's a bunch of them that doesn't, that don't cross paths, but that's the story.
KC2-AYG.
AYG recognized, but hold on for a second. The lineup of those dash numbers you just gave us, will they be the same, essentially, after February 17th? That's part of what I think Paul was asking. Over to you, Eric. Do I have a call?
Yeah, they'll be exactly the same. Pick up that other station, Dick.
Gary, you got your chance now. Go ahead, Gary.
Yes, this is going on with Eric. Eric, we all know what SAP is for, right? Spanish audio programming. I'm questioning, why can't we have EAP on the Spanish programming transferred into English? Why isn't that happening?
Call, please.
Eric's got the floor. Okay, maybe Eric got called away. You may have to repeat your question, Gary, when Eric comes back. For the time being, I think somebody said called. There's a net going on right now. That person making the call, do you have...
In case you told me you back, I have a tall television in my house. One in the kitchen, one in the yellow box. Why the one in the kitchen and the one in the box is delay the voice? I don't hear the same kind of people talking on the same frequency as Channel 7. Back to you.
Well, what did he say, Dick? My ears are not decoding it. I didn't go away.
Okay. Not sure if you're talking about Gary or Alex now. We've had two sets of questions. Gary's question was with reference to language translations. He's a little bit unhappy that some of the Spanish programming is not also available in English. Alex is concerned about the variations in delay. There's two different kinds of delay. I think he's talking about watching two different kinds of sets, one being analog and one being digital. And the digital system, we know there's going to be a significant delay for all the processing to take place for the demodulation. But even within a digital channel, last week we heard the story about the fact that occasionally your receiver will line itself up in such a way that the audio and the video do not exactly line up. They're not lip synced. And so if you turn away from the channel that you're watching, like if you're watching channel 7.1, and you go over to 21.1, and then come back to 7.1, your receiver will realign itself, and sometimes the audio will come back into lip sync. But so that's the lip syncing within a single digital channel. But whenever you're watching analog and digital on two separate sets, there will be a significant time difference between the two. Let's see if Eric's got any words to add today. That's KE2EJ, K2RYW.
All right, first question first. Now I understand what he's saying. Why can't we see the stuff on VMA in English? Okay. Actually, we do. 90% of VMA is the same stuff we put on 13, but it's translated into Spanish. VMA was created, actually it's very popular throughout the entire country. It's a national channel. WNET.org actually generates it. VMA is an independent company, which in essence contracts WNET. Actually, the former vice president of WNET is the now president of VMA. It is distributed to over 200, and I don't remember the exact number, but there is a rather huge Spanish audience. And VMA, and if you listen to the Spanish, be a Spanish-speaking person, the comments that we get all over the country is that the Spanish is just absolutely perfect. The language is beautiful. It's even better than Univision and the other competing Spanish language programming. It does aim towards a different social audience. The ethnicity is the next largest ethnic group within this country. And that's why VMA was created. So 90% of it is nature, great performances, some other shows that are translated specifically for that audience. If you want to watch it in English, go back to 13 if it's done on a given time. But there are certain shows that are aimed at the Spanish or Spanish-speaking audience, and they were created and designed specifically for them. So that's why that exists. I'm going to drop. Now, when we do make digital television, if you've got an analog set playing, not talking about the lip sync problem here, and you happen to have, say, 13 analog on, and you're watching 13 digital at the same time, the 13 digital about 4 seconds later, and you might ask yourself, well, why is that? That has a lot to do with that the whole process of compressing video and turning it into a digital stream. In essence, what we do is we make MPEG-2 out of the analog. I got a camera that's pointed at a clock, and it's ticking off the seconds. And I feed that into an analog transmitter, and you have a clock that's synchronized. Let's say we're looking at WWV clock. What you see on your TV set will agree with the WWV clock. What you see on your digital TV set will be 4 seconds behind. The reason why is in order to compress that signal, it's actually 270 megabits.
if we're talking SD, or standard definition. If we're talking high definition, it's 1.16 gigabits worth of data. Now, we have to squeeze that down into 19 megabits or less. And the only way we can do that is by taking and finding out what happens before, what happens in the middle, and what happens later, and we figure out what suitable, and there's a whole lot of things that go on. There's something called run length encoding, discrete cosine transform. If you've ever worked with a DSP, you do something called a multiply and add. You have to do that many thousands and thousands of times. Because what actually happens is, to make a long story short, if you take an 8x8 square block of pixel, we actually represent that with a single number. Okay, it's a long involved process, but what actually happens is that, you know, a whole bunch of pictures have to get stored first, then we do some arithmetic on it, then we send it out. There's also some more delays that happen in turning it into a transport stream. So by the time the whole process is over, it's 4 seconds later.
Alex, is that the answer you were looking for? Okay, maybe so. And maybe Greg got his answer also. Maybe we're back down to Mel. I don't think we got pretty far into your mailbag. Let's go right ahead again. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Nick, I think we're sort of behind our time because everything that I think we've learned all of a sudden has become kind of ancient. I don't know, good or bad, Nick. We'll have to see, really. I can say we've got a lot of learning to do, and this is a lot of awakening going on. I'm just looking through here and seeing if I can find something here. Yeah, you know, I've been getting, yeah, let me let it drop and I'll tell you what happened. Last week or so, about 10 days ago, what went on in 75 meters one night, it almost wound, I should say it was like a verbal fist fight. It was terrible. It got to very colorful language with a number of the people that came on frequency because some of them, one guy comes on who's very belligerent. He started talking about cable. Somebody had mentioned they had picked up quite a bit of hard line, and he started telling them that how you can't use it, especially on HF. Oh, 8 to 18 dB's lost, and it'll ruin you. If you put a kilowatt into it, it'll go up in fire, and all kinds of nonsense. And I got ridiculously involved with this. Usually I just sit back and say that's it, and this went on. Everything went on until about 2 o'clock in the morning when I finally gave up and I said I got to go to sleep. But the insults continued, and I had directed them previously to our TechNet here, amateurradio.tv, and boy, oh boy, did I get an earful, Dick. So it's a matter of people do not understand. They get started on some nonsense. I don't know where these stupidity start, these ridiculous statements, and boy, oh boy, it sure takes hold. So I got some emails in that vein, as they say, take over.
Yeah, a buddy of mine called me up because he is a college professor of electrical engineering courses that includes transmission lines. And Walt Maxwell's book, W2DU, has a book on reflections, which is out of print. He needed a copy for his class, and he found a copy on eBay, and the person wanted to sell the book for $250. And the book is originally a $20 book, a softcover book. If you go to ARRL.org, and if you are an ARRL member, and you do a search on Walt Maxwell, Maxwell, Walter L, I'm sure, W2DU. You do a search on that. You'll find out they got a beautiful article which includes about eight or for 9 of his consecutive articles that appeared in QST Magazine way back in 1973 timeframe. So in other words, the book is essentially there, and you can download it. And I showed my buddy how to download that program, download that PDF file, and he essentially had the Hold On book in his hand. What's significant about this, let me drop, is that when it comes to misadjusting the impedance that you connect to a coaxial or twin lead transmission line, open wire line, twin lead line, or coaxial line, and what is the true impact of standing wave ratios as low as 1-to-1 and as high as 100-to-1. He's got a beautiful article where the first 8 pages of the article just says, this is a list of things that I can hear when I tune across the ham band, and every one of these things is essentially wrong. And he goes through about 20 statements that have been passed back and forth between ham radio operators over the years, and there are what used to be called old wives' tales. I mean, just because somebody stands on a soapbox, sounds very authoritative, and he says, if you take a 50-ohm antenna and you connect it to a 70-ohm antenna, a 70-ohm transmission line, the world's going to end and everything's going to explode, it's going to go up in fire, and all these bad things are going to happen, and your transmitter's going to fail. There are things almost as ridiculous as that. And step by step, he goes through each one of them. So if you have the ability, by way of a membership of ARRL, to sign into their website and do a search on Walt Maxwell, W2DU, and he's got about 7 or 8 different things you can find there, but one of them is a list of his articles. It doesn't say that. It's worded as further reflections on reflections or something like that. Boy, it makes an awful lot of this a lot clearer. I didn't say it's clear. The number of ways you can misinterpret a transmission line and a reflecting signal because you've got a reactive load or a mismatched impedance load on that line, and therefore you're getting a standing wave ratio. Boy, there's lots and lots of ways of analyzing it, understanding it, misunderstanding it, and getting erroneous information out of it. So, to my knowledge, his series of articles, about the best one you can go to somewhat clear up the waters. It's not going to make it perfectly clear, but I know of no better place to go to that's going to help a whole lot. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, the article was another look at reflection, and I directed that and all, and they don't understand, basically, that's what it comes down to. Don't understand. In fact, I've gotten several questions here, and I've sort of passed them over in the past, they seem to keep coming up. And one of the questions usually is to boil it down to what is the relationship between E, I, and Z, zebra. So I thought if you'd like, we could start a little tutelage. Can't do it all, I don't think, in one night, because I'm going to do some diagram drawing and things like that, some simple drawing. And we could go through this whole situation of what is bulge and current waveform, and how it acts on antennas, how it acts on feed line, and everything like that. And I thought that I did some of that. Some people, when I showed it to them, they said, oh, I see, but... let me tell you something. It was amazing what I heard and what happened. And as I said, we got some very colorful quotations about what we have discussed here on the TechNet stick. Over.
Okay. I'm going to give you 2 paragraphs on the subject. It's just a bare beginning. If my load on the end of a transmission line, the antenna, for instance, just happen to be a pure resistor, and let's assume that I'm only talking about 50-ohm transmission line. So it's a pure resistor, and it's a 50-ohm transmission line. And if I put a 50-ohm load there, and I want to calculate what is the standing wave ratio, you take the load resistance in ohms, and the impedance of the transmission line in ohms, and divide one into the other. A 50-ohm load, a 50-ohm transmission line, 50 over 50, do the division, 1. 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. That one's easy. If the load is 100 ohms and the transmission line is 50, I divide the 50 into 100. I end up with 2. That is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. However, if my load is 25 ohms and the transmission line is 50, the first time I divide it, I'll end up with 0.5. You got to make sure the number always comes out greater than 1. So therefore, instead of dividing the 50 into the 25, you flip the 2 over. You divide the 25 into the 50. If your load is a pure resistor, and you know the ohms of your transmission line, you put one on top and one on the bottom of your fraction, and you do the division, and you know you've done the division right when the answer comes out bigger than 1. So in either case, 25 ohms, I get a 2-to-1 visor, or 100 ohms, I get a 2-to-1 visor. So for the simple situation of a pure resistive load on an ordinary transmission line, calculating the amount of standing wave ratio isn't too difficult. Let me drop and I'll show you the second half. Life gets complicated if the antenna is not a pure resistor. If the antenna happened to be 50 ohms of resistance plus 50 ohms of reactance, doesn't matter if it's a plus reactance, which means inductance, or negative reactance, which means capacitance, if it's 50 plus 50 for the antenna, that simple formula doesn't work. You have to use a more complicated formula. I won't give you that one right now. So at least at the beginning of the process, know also that if you have reactance on the antenna, the visoir goes up faster. I can have 50 ohms all the way up to 100 ohms. I got a 50 ohm error. If it's a pure resistor, I only end up with a 2-to-1. You start adding reactance. Doesn't take anywhere near 50 ohms of reactance to be added before you hit a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Reactance is more critical, more detrimental. Unfortunately, the formula to calculate that as an exact number requires what's called imaginary numbers, and it's not easy. I'm not going to give it to you right now. So that's the beginning of understanding of standing wave ratio. I know you really wanted to know what's the difference between voltage, current, and impedance. The impedance, the Z, is the usual number, the symbol used for impedance, and that was the 25-ohm antenna or the 100-ohm antenna. That was the Z. But if the antenna is more complicated, if the Z for the antenna equals 50 ohms of resistance plus 50 ohms of reactance, 50, 50 is a complicated Z, life gets complicated. You have to use imaginary, you have to use these imaginary numbers, the square root of minus one type stuff, the I and the Q. I won't go there right now. This is the beginning. You probably want to get a little bit more directly into voltage and current. And by the way, the voltage that flows down the transmission line gets completely absorbed by a 50 ohm load, in my example. Anything but pure 50 ohms as a resistor, a certain amount of that voltage becomes reflected and
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
If there's a mismatch, a certain amount of the voltage gets reflected and flows back down the transmission line. And the first question that a common sense person will ask is, how the hell does the transmission line keep the signal that's flowing forward from the signal that's flowing back? How does the transmission line keep them separate? And it does. There's only certain kinds of instrumentation, like a slotted line, that will make you think the two mix together. Until they get into your slotted line probe, they do not mix. Your bird wattmeter has a slug that you can set in the forward direction or the reverse direction, measure forward power or reverse power. Those are independent measurements. The transmission line does not mix them. I know that sounds crazy. K2KEY, K2RIW. Andy recognized, but Mel first, and then we're going to turn it over to Andy. You got it, Mel.
Thanks, Roger. Yeah, I was going to actually start that show how to really draw somewhat of a waveform, and really sort of be able to visualize a little bit more of it. I did this with a couple of people and showed them what's the relationship basically of EI and Z by a more or less of a you know, a graphic type of, you know, indicator, you know, display or whatever you want to call it. But, yeah, because it even, thankfully, they, in the current QST, they did discuss RL, because I did go through this RL before, and the only response I got with that was that I had it backwards, that I had, when I said that.